Jaguars' excitement as the team drafts Trevor Lawrence. Meanwhile, Florida tells transgender girls they can't play sports. And why the city of Jacksonville is still without a public health director. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good morning. This is First Coast Connect. I'm Charles Griggs, sitting in for Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. And just ahead, all the top stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. Then later, previewing the first ever St. Augustine Food and Wine Festival. But first, it's Friday, and here to discuss a busy week in the news, please welcome our guest, Dan Scantling of the Florida Times Union. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning. Good morning, Charlie.
Journalist Claire Goforth. Good morning. We're probably having some problems with her, and our regular contributor, Fred Matthews.
Good morning, Charles. Good to see you.
All right. Good to see you, Fred. And Tim Gibbons, editor of the Jacksonville Business Journal. Good morning, Tim.
Good to be with you.
All right. Let's talk about all the stuff that's going on this week. And why not start? We have to start with the big news from last night. The Jacksonville Jaguars draft for the number one pick, Trevor Lawrence, a quarterback out of Clemson University. And it is the talk of the town, the story of the week, and this has been brewing for some time now, ever since the Jaguars went 1-15 last season, which opened the door for them to have the first pick of the draft. Last night also saw them draft in the 25th spot, Travis Etienne. He's the running back that played with Trevor Lawrence with Clemson University. And while on this program we typically don't talk about sports, it is fitting that we do because this is the biggest news in Jacksonville to date. Fred Matthews, what do you think this is going to do for ticket sales as well as the winning tradition that the Jaguars were used to back in the early days?
Well, if last night was any indication for those who flew up to Cleveland to be there and for the young lady who was the first one to sit in the commissioner's chair, and the packed house at the stadium, relatively packed house at the stadium, and those down at the old Jacksonville landing site having fun, it's going to be a great time. I mean, everybody is just itching to, number one, just to get out and be amongst other bodies. So I expect it to be the first of this season, attendance-wise, to be one of the best that the Jaguars have seen. I would expect that the coach will not be playing Mr. Lawrence out of the gate for a number of professional reasons. Folks need to be prepared for that. This young man has never played a down in the NFL, and he just went through a surgery. Remember that. And so I don't expect to see Trevor Lawrence on the field, at least for the first six games. Don't forget about Minshew.
Claire Goforth, we think we have you back on the air now. What do you think this means for the city of Jacksonville as it continues to struggle with its image within the NFL as a top-tier team?
Well, it certainly infuses a lot of hope into the franchise, and I do think that we'll see increased ticket sales as a result. I do think that we'll probably see more ticket sales increase if Tim Tebow ends up on the team. I heard yesterday that he had tried out for tight end, and there was no word last I heard whether or not they had decided to bring him on. You know, the Jacksonville Jaguars have been struggling a lot in the last few years, but I have to disagree with Fred. I think that we will probably see Trevor Lawrence sooner rather than later on the field because we just don't have the depth of talent at quarterback that we need.
Yeah, Dan Scantling, the Times Union has done some in-depth reporting. No one can go anywhere without hearing the name Trevor Lawrence over the last, 5 months towards the end of the football season. And now, here we go into the beginning of the next 2021 season. What do you see in terms of how this impacts economically for Duval County and for Jacksonville and the surrounding areas? Do you think that this draft pick or the two draft picks in this case will help with gaining a new fan base outside of Jacksonville?
Well, Jacksonville Jesus and franchise savior are some of the phrases I'm seeing on social media about young Mr. Lawrence, and he certainly has made his impact already here with making that donation shortly after his marriage. I think with COVID and lifting and inoculations We're going to see a lot more folks in that stadium anyway. And now we've got someone to cheer about who's young and apparently has never lost any of his college games. So once he gets over the jitters of being with the big leagues, I would expect if there's even a good show of his quarterback abilities, more people will just start showing up. We are a buy a ticket the day of city, so I wouldn't be surprised walk-up sales increase.
Tim Gibbons, from a business perspective, what we saw last night was about 6,000 fans who came out to the stadium. It was basically a situation where the Jaguars were allowing a certain number of people. Certainly, if the Jaguars wanted to have more, they could have. But they were allowing a certain amount of fans a special privilege to be out at the stadium for the big event. What does it look like in terms of how the fans continue to respond to the types of events and activities that the Jaguars are like to put on outside of the football game to create that fan experience?
There's been a huge response. We were talking to the Jaguars, kind of looking at the business implications of this draft pick, and season ticket sales are up. And interestingly, there are people that the Jags have not necessarily had a connection with before. So it's not people who abandoned the team. It's new fans. It's fans who are getting excited. And sponsors are responding as well. I mean, you can imagine if you're TIA Bank, the hoopla around this, the entire attention being paid, and their name is there on the stadium. If you're, the sponsor of the draft party last night, they're getting this huge attention from fans, and I think the city will end up getting huge attention compared to how it has been in the past. When you look at Trevor Lawrence's social media presence, he has more followers on Instagram than the team does. We're close to it. So the attention being paid to the city, to the team, and to Lawrence, it's going to be a boon for the entire area.
Yeah, we'll continue to talk about this. If you want to get involved in the conversation, the number to call is 549-2937. We're talking about Trevor Lawrence being drafted by the Jacksonville Jaguars as a number one overall pick in last night's NFL draft. Fred, I mentioned earlier that the team continues to struggle with this image within the NFL itself. There was a significant amount of criticism of the Jaguars for potentially sort of tanking on purpose last year towards the end of the season, just so they can put themselves in the position to get to pick Mr. Lawrence. And some of the commentators, national commentators, didn't take too kindly to Jacksonville having the opportunity to bring such a prize quarterback to its market. What do you think about his opportunities to turn around the image of this franchise as it relates to the way the NFL perceives the team in Jacksonville?
Well, it was, what was it, a competition between Jacksonville and Miami for who was going to tank first and who was going to be
Jackson,
the lowest.
The Jets. The New York Jets.
Yes. Ah, that's right, because they did have the second pick last night. So, it's just a question who's going to win that particular lottery, and Jacksonville won it, 1-15. You know, that being, it is what it is. We'll never know the truth of that. We can only see what we saw on the field, and we can see the choices that Jacksonville made up to that, trading away some of the most veteran and well-liked and great players in the league to other teams, leaving them with basically nothing, and having basically two, I won't call them second and third rate, but they weren't top-tier quarterbacks to try to lead this team, and it just wasn't anything there. So, the evidence speaks for itself. Now, that being said, it would be unfortunate to put the entire weight of the city and the franchise on this young man's shoulders, because they still have a team they have to build around him. And, of course, remember, there are other people in the NFL who would be targeting this new young quarterback for their own purposes around the league to win. So there's a lot of factors to be involved here, and it would be yet another mistake to put all the weight of the world on this young man's shoulders. Many first-round picks, there's only been about 15 first-round picks that have gone on to be Hall of Famers in the NFL. So there's a lot of time that has to be put in over the next, now what, 4 months before the games begin? And Jacksonville needs to just take a step back, enjoy the game, but don't add any more weight to this young man's shoulders before the season starts. And, of course, don't forget, they hired a new running back for him last night, who's also got to get his sea legs straight in the NFL.
Yeah, Claire, one of the criticisms of Shad Khan has been that he has not been able to field a consistent winning franchise team on the field. The only winning season it was when 2017, when they came within an eyelash of going to the Super Bowl. And some people believe that the hiring of head coach Urban Meyer, who has only been successful on the college level, has no NFL coaching experience, and then being put in position to get this number one pick is somewhat cosmetic in order to continue to make the Jaguars viable for the local market, so they can expand outside of football, projects like Lot J and some of the future projects that the ownership group is maybe having on the horizon. What do you think about how serious they are about putting together a winning franchise for the long term? Do you think that there's any validity to the fact that since this is an inexperienced franchise when it comes to winning, and that this may be an opportunity or may not be an opportunity to really sink a long-term winning tradition into the franchise?
Well, I do think that Shad Khan wants to win. It's really hard to argue otherwise, but there are a lot of questions about whether or not at some point he wants to move the team to London. There are indications that he wants to do that. I mean, they were taking two home games away and playing them in London, but you'd have to get permission from the NFL for that. I mean, picking Urban Meyer, who, while untested on the NFL stage, is a brilliant college coach, that signals a very serious intent to create a winning team. And everybody knows that a winning team changes everything about the attitude in the city about the franchise, the willingness of people to spend their money, go down to the stadium, spend money around the stadium, which increases the likelihood of development in the area around it, such as Lot J. It's sort of like a domino effect. You start putting those wins down and people stop wondering, well, why does Jacksonville have an NFL franchise? I mean, nobody's asking that about Indianapolis, which is about the same population. So, you put those wins down on the field, and then we can start see a lot of things happening in the business world and in the, of course, the sports commentator world that will change the perception of Jacksonville and the Jaguars.
Yeah, so that's the thing when it comes to having a winning college coach. It translates to Pete Carroll up in Seattle has been successful, as well as Jimmy Johnson when he formerly coached the Dallas Cowboys and then later the Miami Dolphins. Dan, I want to ask you, one of the things that's happened during all of this madness is that we've completely forgotten about Minshew Mania. What are they going to do with Gardner Minshew now and how do you think that guy feels, knowing that last year he was the guy and all of a sudden he's not?
Well, he was the guy and then he sort of lost some of his luster. But if Minshew becomes the starter in some of the early games and then our new man on the spot comes in and they work together with Minshew as a backup. And if Tim Tebow actually shows up and we've got this college-centric team, maybe that's a plus for them, because with a college coach and a college quarterback and an ex-college Tebow, maybe there's some magic that gets developed there. It could be an interesting brew to watch.
Yeah, I think I'll have to remind people that this is the NFL.
Minshew, obviously, I think the luster got lost last year. Whether he can try out again or whether he ends up seeking employment elsewhere, who knows? He's been very quiet on social the past few months, other than a new hairstyle. So who knows?
Yeah. And Claire mentioned earlier that Tim Tebow was worked out for a spot at tight end. And this seems fairly odd, coming from a professional football standpoint. It's very rare that any type of talent in one position would, be out of the league for a significant amount of time and then come back and try it at another position and be successful at that.
That was the talk when he, you know, originally of moving to that position, that he might have actually had a longer NFL career. But I mean, he's pretty old to try to get back into the game. You know, it clearly in Jacksonville, you can imagine the fan excitement if he took the field. But as you said, it does seem like it's hard for someone of that age, frankly, just to get back into the game. But, you know, you can't discount somebody with his work ethic and his background. You know, I guess anything is possible. And obviously having the new coach makes it a different situation.
Okay. Well, we're going to continue to look at this and keep our eye out, you know, for we would imagine that Trevor Lawrence will be making an appearance in Jacksonville probably sometime today. He and Travis Etienne, and we'll get our first glimpse at the newest Jacksonville Jaguars. And the excitement will continue as we move forward and get ready for another NFL football season here in Jacksonville, Florida. Also making headlines this week, last night, the Florida Senate sent a controversial bill to the governor's desk. It would ban transgender girls from participating in school sports. This bill had died, but it was brought back in a sudden development as the state legislative session comes to a close. Claire Gofer, you know, what do you think about this? The governor has said that once it reaches his desk, he's going to sign it. This is one of those bills that seems to be very partisan, much like a lot of the legislation that most of the legislation that goes through session. How will this impact transgender students as they seek to participate in sports?
Well, I mean, it certainly sets them up for a lot of discrimination, and it creates sort of two classes of women. And, you know, like you said, it's extremely partisan. You really don't hear any support for it on the left. Even people who have some concerns about whether or not it is fair to have transgender, it's always girls that they talk about, play girl sports in school. You know, the data just, it doesn't back up these fears. If you look nationally there and internationally, there just really isn't any kind of examples where there's any concern that this is somehow going to fundamentally alter women's sports and alter women's ability to excel at sports. It's just fear-mongering. You know, DeSantis and his colleagues in the Republican Party are catering to the white Wonder Bread people who fear the other. They fear transgender people. They fear Black Power. That's why we see the anti-protest bill that is also, you know, law now. And I mean, their calculus, it just seems to be quite cynical. It seems as though they are just thinking about their donors and a very small part of their base, and they're not thinking about Americans generally, and they're not thinking about the future. I don't think future generations are going to look back on them favorably.
Yeah, Fred, why is this bill even necessary, and how did it make it back as it had died previously, and you know, how did it get back on the radar right before session ended? It's one of those things that you know you're never surprised by anything that happens during legislative session, but it seems like some type of compromise was reached by Senate leaders in order to make this happen towards the end. Why is this even necessary, Fred?
Well, on some high school levels, there have been attempts by transgender individuals to participate in sports, just as all young people have participated in sports over the years. And there have been rejection of them in certain high schools around the state. And then that spurred a couple lawsuits to have these young people be able to participate.
Mm-hmm.
This then filtered itself, as they always do, up to the legislature. As you see, this is occurring relatively late, so it was not a big agenda item. But that's what kind of spurred this up, is that there have been attempts to participate on the high school level particularly, and they've been rejected, and lawsuits came up, and thus the legislature, those who were inclined to take a look at this, said, okay, it's no big deal. And again, as Claire indicated, you know, we're in a conservative political climate here in Florida, and particularly with the legislature. This was a no-brainer for them to pass preventing transgender youth from participating in something. It doesn't matter what the data is. They were not going to consider it. It was easy for them to pass. They have the votes to do it. Just pass it and be done with it and move on to the next thing. It is it's just one of those unfortunate things that we're having to live through in a conservative political climate. It's ironic because on the other end of the spectrum, there has been a bipartisan effort this past week to approve police reform in the state legislature, which kind of surprised me. Cord Byrd being one of those participating with that legislation with some other rather progressive Democratic leaders to approve of, approval of a police reform bill. But again, that's where we are.
Yeah, and it's very interesting. We'll talk a little bit more about that a little later. But it looks, in addition to banning transgender girls and women from participating in school sports, the bill would have required any dispute of the student's biological sex to be resolved by a healthcare provider by examining the student's reproductive anatomy. Sounds very intrusive on the top level there, and that is one of the sticking points where people are very hesitant to have this done, support this bill, I should say, and as well as. How do you get into the nuts and bolts of who's doing what and who's doing who in this particular case? Also, what we know is that the Olympic organization they've been allowing transgender students, individuals to go through trials, since 2003, but no one has actually made it to competition in that time. So we'll continue to watch that. Dan, I wanted to ask you about this. You're very familiar with the legislature and how it works. What do you think, how much of an impact is this going to actually have on how students qualify for those students who want to participate? Are there going to be lawsuits? Is this going to generate lawsuits coming down the line?
I think you've predicted that immensely. Within the next few weeks of signature, I'm sure there will be legal action from not only organizations and sports groups, but from the parents and even some of the students. I mean, the Human Rights Campaign has already indicated quite forcefully that there's more than 250 anti-LGBTQ bills under consideration. More than 120 of those directly target transgender people. And they say there's lots of bipartisan opposition to this kind of bill from professional and collegiate sporting organizations, athletes, faith leaders, legal scholars, and 90 corporations. So the opposition is out there, even from the groups who hopefully will eventually hire a transgender sports star and make some nice positive news out there.
Okay, we do have a call on this. John is on the South Side. John?
Yes, I had a question for Claire earlier about the comments on transgender women being in sports.
Go ahead.
So Claire, I mean, if you ask high school athletes, women, if they think that transgender women should be able to join sports, you'll hear a resounding no. And you said there's no data to back up that they don't mess up the sports at all. There are transgender athletes that go in wrestling track that will dominate the entire league. And if you ask the girls if transgender women should be able to play, you'll hear a resounding no. I mean, would it be fair to the women that have worked their whole lives to be in the WNBA and LeBron decides to switch where he'll score 800 points in a game and just crash everybody's dreams? No. The transgender women that join high school sports take scholarship opportunities away, and they don't make it fun for the girls to play, and especially in sports like wrestling and track, which are the two most common ones. I mean, what would you say to the girls that work for going getting a scholarship? They work really hard. And then someone that was born a male comes along, dominates it, and takes away scholarship opportunities from them.
Thank you for that, John. Claire, you want to respond to John's?
Of course. And John is saying a lot of people feel that way. And really, while there have been very isolated cases of transgender girls who have dominated in their sport, by and large, that is not what happens. And to say that they're taking a scholarship away from someone else is to say that they don't deserve a scholarship. And there's a sort of underlying idea behind some of this thinking is that a a male who is not trans will become trans in order to dominate in a sport. And that is just not what happens. It's, you know, that people don't choose to be trans. People are trans. And if we say that they're not worthy of a scholarship opportunity, we're basically saying that they don't have the same value as somebody else. You have to think about it, you know, as these are human beings and, you know, they are equally deserving of a scholarship as anyone else. There certainly will be some things to be worked out, and this is something that we will follow. We don't have very much data on this at this point. There's just a lot of fear and concern. And, like, let's just try to treat people equally and wait for a problem before we try to legislate one.
Yeah, one of the interesting pieces as well is that the NCAA has indicated that if this bill is signed into law, they're considering taking action by not allowing NCAA sanctioned sports to tournaments, I believe, in Florida. So this may have economic impact as well as we continue to look forward. We have another caller on the line. Ed is in Clay County. Ed, good morning.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
My question is simply, some people believe that there's basically little or no difference between the sexes when it comes to physical abilities. Why don't we just eliminate completely the difference between having female and male teams in high school and college and anywhere, and just have two teams, A and B, and whoever makes it, and have complete open competition and see who ends up taking all the positions. My suspicion is that women will be mostly wiped out. Unfortunately or fortunately, depending on the way you look at it or just reality, there are differences. And if I was a young man right now, I don't make it to a varsity team, and I'm afraid of losing a scholarship in a high school or college, I would say that I am identifying as a female or a lesbian. You still can go out with your girlfriend anyway and win the scholarship. When you introduce money, which is what happens in these cases with scholarships, incentives go up to do whatever it takes. And that was my comment. Thank you much.
Okay. Thank you for that, Ed. Danielle is on the line from Jacks Beach. Danielle, good morning.
We need to cheer them on.
Good morning, Danielle.
Encourage them, but not compete against them and pull them down, because I do believe that there is a difference.
Okay. Can you restate that for us, Danielle? Because I think we cut off your first part.
Yeah. So I'm a transgender female.
Okay.
And I really do believe that, you know, female transgender women should not play in women's sports. And the reason being is because they do. That, you know, if they really want to support females or women, they should be out there rooting for them or encourage them to, you know, win, but not compete against them.
Okay. Let me ask you a question, Danielle. Do you think that the legislation is necessary in order to encourage trans women to not participate? Do you think that there should be a law in place to prevent that, or should it be something that people like you mentioned, you just discuss and come to some sort of agreement that this is something you don't want to do?
Honestly, I think, you know, there should be some sort of legislation, because there's no way to really regulate it. Because you're going to have some people that transitioned early in life that may not have developed as much, like Jazz. She didn't develop as much as I did. I transitioned later in life. But I've seen transgender women that have transitioned at, you know, 25 and 30, and, yeah, they still, you know, and you do lose a lot. If you fully transition, you lose a lot of muscle mass. You lose a lot of your strength. I think there has to be something in place to be able to help that, because you're going to have some people that just feel like, well, I'm transgender and I transitioned fully and I should be accepted 100%. And I believe that you should be accepted as a female if you fully transition. And, you know, but if you're going to, you know, go up against women that have been naturally born cis females, then, yeah, I think that's wrong.
Okay. Well, thank you for your comments, Danielle. We really appreciate your call. Tim, what do you think about Danielle's comments? It seems to be supporting the legislation and not seem to be an overreach here like we've been, like the opponents have been reporting on or at least talking about. What do you think about Danielle's comment?
I mean, obviously it's a issue that has strong feelings on both sides. What I am curious about with anything like this, and I'm not saying that any of the callers we have today are not truly concerned with these issues. I do think that there are people who have deep concerns. My cynical side says, though, that the reason for the legislation is as a political talking point. It kind of reminds me back, you know, when there was the entire discussion about banning trans students from using the bathroom of their preferred gender, and you know, people lost their minds, and the school district kind of said, "Oh yeah, we've been doing this for years, and there hasn't been a problem." I think that many of the issues around trans rights oftentimes come down to people looking for a thing that you know they want to get upset about, that they want to raise money based on, and are putting things like this legislation into place. Not so much out of concern for an actual issue, but because it's good politics, and that's a shame. We're talking about real people's lives, and you know, playing politics with people's lives does seem somewhat distasteful.
Yeah, this is a very controversial issue, and as we can tell by the amount of phone calls we're getting on this issue regarding how this legislation came into place, and if it's even necessary in the first place. Fred, what do you think about the comments that we've gotten so far? We seem to be getting people in support of the bill who really think this is necessary in order to regulate how transgender individuals participate in high school sports.
Well, I think it's typical. And given the demographics of where the callers are calling from, it would be expected. Look, there's no, as Claire's indicated, there's just not enough, there's no statistical evidence that shows that this will make a great deal of difference in women's sports. There's just not. This is another case of sex and politics, which always makes for a good firebrand to run for. you know, if some of us believe that that all of us are equal and should be given an equal chance to participate and try and fail on their own, then let them participate and try and fail on their own. There's just nothing there except that I don't want it. I don't like it. I'm not going to try to participate against Serena Williams in a tennis match. I'm not going to do it. Okay? Because I can't, you know, she can't play. I'm not going to participate against Michelle Wee in a golf match. Because I'm not that good. She's good. I mean, they're. If you can play, you can play. If you can play well, you can play well. If you can participate in it, you can participate in it. In wrestling matches, we have weight divisions. So you're not going to wrestle against somebody that's 250 pounds and you weigh 135. If a boxing match, you're not going to box against somebody who weighs 135 pounds and you weigh 250. There are divisions of that in sports for reasons to allow people to participate on equal ground. But when we take this into the political arena, it becomes less about the data and more about scoring political points with your constituents, and the majority of constituents that these legislators represent are in conservative districts who don't want to hear anything about transgender anything. They don't want to hear it.
Okay.
And it's never going to get passed out of there. It would have to be, this will have to be decided through court action in order for anything to move forward from a progressive standpoint.
Okay. We have another call from Lene. Lene, thank you for joining us this morning.
Hi, yes. I was a women's studies major in college as well as a student athlete. I completely understand how hard it is to compete at the NCAA level. But I'd like to point out that the suicide rates amongst LGBT youth are up to 3 times higher than heterosexual youth, and I just don't believe that there are teenagers and young adults who are going to act as though they are transgender women in the hopes of receiving a college scholarship. Even if they did that and they were to succeed and perform really well, they would be ridiculed so much. I just can't imagine that would be any student's motivating factor.
Okay, thank you for your comments. Thank you for your comments. Dan, you know, what do you think about some of the data that's really, I mean, the information we're receiving that says that there is a controversy, it seems to be some type of controversy, disagreement, I should say, not merely controversy, among people within the trans community about how this or should this be applied. Certainly, there are people who believe that that there is a need for this bill. But it sounds like there are many people who believe that there is not, and that that trans people who are trans who are making this, they are capable of making the decisions on their own and don't need any type of regulation in order to, you know, to do so.
Well, I found it interesting that Danielle, who obviously knows what it means to transition, made the comments about gender assignment early versus later, and that obviously hormone treatment might change the male strength, over the years, and she would know. But I think it's just sad that this is a topic that is being discussed right now and so controversial. There are a lot of other things in the state of Florida that need to be addressed on the local and state level. Crime, one of them, and don't forget that a few years ago we had a number of transgender homicides in Jacksonville, and there seemed to be some opinion that they were being targeted. So it's a concern. There's other things that we should be worried about. I think this, I don't think, is one of them.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I'm glad you brought that up, because I do want to quickly, before we move out of this segment, talk about the police reform bill that was brought up earlier. It looks like that there is bipartisan support for this bill, this legislation. Claire, do you want to talk a little bit more about what this means to, to the state of Florida, and how some of those hurdles that we've been trying to address as relates to police reform? It seems like, trying to get the law enforcement community to budge on anything has been very difficult, but in the wake of the death and of George Floyd and the conviction of Eric Chauvin, it seems like perhaps maybe we may be in a position to get some bipartisan agreement on a few things that may help move us forward.
Well, I mean, not to be overly cynical, but I will believe it when I see it. They're talking now, and that is a good sign. For many years, we have had serious issues with a lack of accountability on police forces, and part of the reason for that is the Officers' Bill of Rights and other laws that make it very difficult to prosecute, and also internal policies that make it difficult to punish police officers who use excessive force. So I reserve judgment on whether or not this is going to really make a difference until it is reality, but it is a good sign that we're seeing bipartisan cooperation on this, because that's not really been the case for quite a long time. And I think that we'll all just kind of be on a wait and see. And I'm certain that they're all going to be getting a lot of pressure from constituents, and also importantly from the police lobby.
Yeah. Lawmakers call it a start. The bill requires every law enforcement agency to have a use of force policy that includes certain provisions, essentially creating a minimum statewide standard for how police use force, which was the main, the main crux of the Eric Chauvin case up in Minnesota, where he placed his knee on George Floyd's neck for 9 minutes and 29 seconds. Most of us would call that excessive use of force. But the state is now looking for a consistent policy around what use of force would be. Fred Matthews, where do you see this going? Will there be more, some more legislation with teeth in it down the road, or is this, sort of window dressing, like Claire says, she's going to reserve judgment on it. Is this sort of window dressing for bipartisan movement on how we address police reform?
I don't think it's so much a window dressing as it's a fairly easy bill as it's now written. Of course, this matter has passed the House, the Florida House. It's going on to the Senate, where a companion bill, believe it or not, seems to have is a little more progressive than the bill they'll be receiving from the House. Yeah. It may not make it in time. Yeah. Before the legislative session ends to get passed and get to the governor's desk. It is progressive in that.
Actually, Fred, the bill did pass, so it was just waiting on the governor's signature.
Oh, it did pass. Yes. Good. Okay, because I missed that part of it. I know it went over there. So if it's gone that far, it's a no-brainer for the governor to pass. It doesn't conflict with the anti-riot bill that they just passed. The police are still free to do whatever they want to you if you threaten them. This bill merely says, it's one of the biggest things in the bill, that they can't put a chokehold on you, and that they'll form these quasi commissions in counties who want to do this to give the public some sense that they're looking to be fair. But it doesn't change. It fundamentally doesn't change the issues that are at the forefront. In police reform across the country, and we'll see how it meshes with what may be coming through Congress in the couple of years in the future here before that gets through. But I would expect that the governor will sign it. Okay. It won't hurt anything, and the Sheriff's Association and those are not opposed to it.
Okay, very good. We'd like to try to get in one more topic as we get ready to close out our roundtable. The Duval County Health Department has not had a director since 2018. There's a local requirement that the director has to be a physician. Some council members wanted to eliminate that requirement. The bill died Tuesday night without any movement or any talk about moving it forward. Claire Goforth, I don't know if you've been following this, but this is something I know you've been writing in the past about the health department. But this bill was seen as something that shouldn't have been controversial. But when it came up for a final vote on Tuesday night, all of a sudden, it became controversial because it didn't seem like it had the support from the community that it needed.
Yeah, it was one of those interesting only in Jacksonville moments, I think. Everyone sort of thought it was just going to slide on through, but no, in fact, it did not. I mean, the question is whether or not the director of the health department needs to be a physician. And there are some people who think that, yes, the director should be a physician because of the unique experience and training that goes into that, and the fact that you have to sort of weigh things that are very technical medical issues. And then there are some that say, well, if you have experience in public health, then that should be sufficient. And, I would say that the fact that we haven't had a director for 3 years is indicative that maybe they need to loosen the restrictions or at least look harder. But, I guess we'll be waiting and seeing on this one as well, whether or not they're going to pass that legislation, because it sounds like ultimately they're going to try again.
Yeah. Dan, one of the challenges for this bill was the fact that the health director's pay is so low, in relation to how other health professionals are being paid. I think it was between $140,000 and $160,000, which caused a problem when it came to finding qualified individuals to apply for the job.
Well, certainly any doctor who has the administrative skills to run the health department was probably making a lot more than that and would be loath to depart from private practice to do it. I found it interesting. The job's been posted 3 times in the last 3 years and that no one has come forward. Again, there's many, many health departments and many government health agencies being run by administrators. Some who actually know what they're doing because they've got some private health insurance or health practice experience. I just don't know why we haven't heard about this until now when it ends up getting postponed in city council.
Yeah, Tim, it seems like this, you know, it was a, you know, sort of a short time frame, even though the bill did go through a regular bill cycle. You know, what are your thoughts on what they may be doing going forward?
I mean, it's one of those situations that it's somewhat inside baseball, but it's a decision that will affect a lot of people's lives. And clearly there are different skill sets. There are important skill sets that are needed in that position. And I think the key thing is getting someone in that job who can actually help the county deal with all of the health issues that they're facing, particularly now as we're still in the waning days of the pandemic.
Okay. All right. Well, that's probably going to be as much time as we have for this week. I want to thank our guests, our panelists today, Claire Goforth, Tim Gibbons, Dan Scatlin, and Fred Matthews. Thank you very much for joining us on this week's roundtable. And we'll look forward to having you next time.
Thanks, Charles.
Thank you.
Thanks, Charles.
All right.
See you later.
All right. Coming up, a conversation about the St. Augustine Wine Festival.
Biggest stories affecting the Sunshine State. Hi, I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Join us Friday for the Florida Roundup.
Each week at noon, we interview newsmakers and people from across the state discussing the stories and issues that affect your life. What's driving the conversation in Florida?
Join the conversation on the Florida Roundup.
Every Friday at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
The president urges Congress to act on police reform.
We've all seen the knee of injustice on the neck of black Americans.
But Republicans say Biden's agenda will only drive the country further apart.
It's backwards to fight discrimination with different types of discrimination.
A lot of politics, and we'll remember a man who took us to the moon and back. It's the Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. The inaugural St. Augustine Food and Wine Festival is coming up next weekend. Chef Brian Whittington of Preserve Chop Shop will be cooking up delicious dishes at the event, and he's on the line with a preview. Good morning, Chef.
How you doing, sir?
All right. So tell us about the St. Augustine Food and Wine Festival. How did it come about, and what are your expectations for a successful event?
Well, it was brought up to us. We actually have done a couple other events with the group that put the festivals on. We had done the Savannah Food and Wine Festival, and about 4 or 5 months ago, they came to us with wanting to be able to do one here in St. Augustine, so we obviously jumped at the opportunity. The event's going to be 6th through the 9th, and you know, it's going to showcase not only local chefs, but also some large talent from all around the country. So this is obviously going to be the inaugural year of doing it. It's our first year, so everybody's super excited to make sure that it obviously goes off without any hiccups. So we expect it to showcase not only what St. Augustine is doing, but all of Northeast Florida. And the cool thing about that is, like I said, it's going to bring chefs in town that are at the top of their game, some of those being Michael Sullivan from American Butcher, which ties in really well with us, being that we own the butcher shop, Chop Shop. And then another large one, which most of you have probably heard about, is Manit Chauhan, who actually just won the Food Network competition. So it'll bring a lot of notoriety, I think, to the city, which is huge for us. I think almost every local chef here in town is excited because they know that it's going to bring a large amount of people into town to kind of showcase what we're doing here in our city. So
yeah, it looks like you have a bunch of featured locations, a few featured locations throughout the festival event area. Talk about why, you know, how you decided to do this in multiple locations and why that's significant.
Well, the majority of it is going to be out at World Golf. Obviously, the reason for that is, you know, we're socially distanced. The World Golf Hall of Fame, obviously, is a massive area, which allows us to do a lot of outside events. I know that was one of the biggest reasons for going out there. But, I mean, the events are going to basically go all the way from Thursday through Sunday. Thursday kind of starting off with the largest dinner, the winemaker's dinner. I believe that there are a few tickets left over for that, but you'd have to go to the website. And then Friday, I know Friday's kind of more relaxed, casual, kind of cool day. We have a bunch of Epicurean classes out at World Golf. That's also going to showcase multiple chefs doing demonstrations on a cooking stage. It's also going to have the local distillery, St. Augustine Distillery, with Philip McDaniel and their head distiller, Clark Gilmore. I'll be there doing multiple cooking stages. Manit Chauhan will actually be there. Greg Norman Estates Wine will be there. Jan Stevenson will be there. And then Friday night, there'll actually be another cool event called Smoke on the Walk, which will be out at World Golf as well. Multiple chefs, multiple pit masters from all around the country will be there. I think it's $89 a person. Still tickets available, 6:30 to 8:30. Basically a bunch of smoked food, live music, drinks. So I believe that event is 21 and up. And then Friday and Saturday. Saturday actually be the main event from 1 to 4 p.m., which will be doing chef demos, cooking demonstrations, tastings, beverages, and I think that goes from 1 to 4, $75 per person. That's also a 21 and over. And then Sunday, you have the large Sunday brunch. So a lot of stuff going on in a four-day period.
Yeah, that Sunday brunch sounds very interesting, especially since it's Mother's Day.
I'm almost positive that event has sold out because it is Mother's Day. So,
wow, that's I think that's a great idea to have a jazz brunch on Mother's Day. And what a better way to celebrate our mothers out there than to take that special mom out to the St. Augustine Food and Wine Festival.
I agree.
Yeah, tell us about the entertainment for the jazz brunch.
So I know there'll be live music almost every night. Pretty sure that event, so if you go to the jazz brunch,
I think you have
a
Sam
local
Pacetti.
Guy. I know a local guy here in town, Sam Pacetti, who's actually been playing music here in town for, it's got to have been at least 20 plus years. It's kind of cool to kind of see him being a part of this event. He's gotten a lot of notoriety over the past 10 or 15 years locally, so it's pretty cool to kind of see him being out there. So
yeah. And here at WJCT, we're going to be giving away a pair of general admission tickets to the main event to enter for our listeners. Please email us at firstcoastconnect@WJCT and put tickets in the subject matter line there. And you'll be entered an opportunity to win tickets to the main event, which you mentioned earlier. That's Saturday from 1 to 4 p.m., the St. Augustine Food and Wine Festival. So, this sounds like a very, and since it's the inaugural event, what do you need to do in order for it to be another one this time next year?
I actually was talking with Jan Gorley last night, who is the partner of the AdFish group who's putting on the event. And from very early on when she brought it to us, obviously our goal was to be able to make it as easy for them as possible, because we want to make sure that it returns to our city. Again, it's a huge opportunity to be able to have something come into our city similar to the Charleston Food and Wine Festival, the Savannah Food and Wine Festival. So our goal was to be able to, make sure that it goes very well. I think it's one of the reasons why we potentially are involved in doing events all 4 days, while also running a butcher shop, while also running a restaurant. I think you know that the local chefs and the people that are coming in town that are a part of the event are also aware that, listen, whatever it takes, we're going to make sure that it goes off very well to make sure that it returns next year. Mm-hmm. And with the conversation that I had with her last night, it went well. Most of the events sold out pretty quickly. Financially, I believe it did pretty well. So I'd imagine next year we'll be talking about the exact same event right around the same time.
Okay. Well, we appreciate it. We appreciate the opportunity and good luck this weekend, next weekend with the St. Augustine Food and Wine Festival. Chef Brian Whittington, Preserve Chop Shop. We look forward to the event next week. And that's our program. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is our director. Thank you, Josh. Our news director is Jessica Palumbo, and Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor. If you have any questions or comments about First Coast Connect, please send an email to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. I'm Charles Griggs, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT 89.9 Jacksonville. We'll be back on Monday. But if you missed anything, you can listen to our rebroadcast at 8 p.m. and find today's show at wjct.org or on your favorite podcast platform. Have a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.